Instead, the thought flashed through my mind, why have they contacted me, a humble aircraft worker, a nobody? The voice replied, we see the individuals of Earth as each one really is, Orfeo, and not as perceived by the limited senses of man. The people of your planet have been under observation for centuries, but have only recently been resurveyed. Every point of progress in your society is registered with us. We know you as you do not know yourselves. Every man, woman and child is recorded in vital statistics by means of our recording crystal disks. Each of you is infinitely more important to us than to your fellow Earthlings because you are not aware of the true mystery of your being. From among you we singled out three individuals who, from the standpoint of our higher vibrational perception, are best fitted for establishing contact. All three are simple, humble and presently unknown persons. Of the other two, one is living in Rome and the other in India. But for our first contact with the people of Earth, Orfeo, we have chosen you. We feel a deep sense of brotherhood toward Earth's inhabitants because of an ancient kinship of our planet with Earth. In you we can look far back in time and recreate certain aspects of our former world. With deep compassion and understanding we have watched your world going through its growing pains. We ask that you look upon us simply as older brothers. The voice continued, speaking rather rapidly. It stated that they were well aware that the flying saucers had been treated humorously by most people, as it was meant they should be. In this way they wanted the people of Earth to become only gradually aware of them and grow accustomed to the idea of space visitors. It was best that we receive them lightly at first for the sake of our own stability. The voice stated that the disks were powered and controlled by tapping into universal magnetic forces, thus their activated molecules received and converted energy inherent in all the universe. It further explained that the complexities of the apparently simple structure of their disks were so great that to unearthing a saucer would be considered as having synthetic brains, although each one is to a degree under the remote control of a mothership. Also, most of the saucers, as well as the spacecraft of other planetary evolutions, are of a circular shape and vary in size from a few inches to hundreds of feet in diameter. A disk, the voice continued, is able not only to relay whatever is transmitted to it from a mothership, but also it records precisely all visual, auditory and telepathic impressions that come within the scope of the disk. These impressions are relayed to the mothership where they are permanently recorded upon what Earthlings would popularly term synthetic crystal brains. Thus for centuries has been recorded a detailed account of Earth's civilization and the spiritual evolution of individual persons. The voice also stated that in addition to the remotely controlled saucers there also existed spaceships, some of which had been seen by Earthlings. It was further explained that the etheric entities in reality had no need of spacecraft of any type and when they were employed by them it was only for purposes of material manifestation to men. I distinctly remember the voice making some such statement as this: interplanetary ships and saucers of various material densities can approximate the speed of light. This seems impossible to you only because of a natural principle which has not yet been discovered by your scientists. Also, the speed of light is the speed of truth. This statement is presently unintelligible to Earth's peoples, but is a basic cosmic axiom. Approaching the speed of light, the time dimension, as known upon Earth, becomes non-existent. Hence in this comparatively new dimension there are incredibly rapid means of space travel which are beyond man's comprehension. Also, within the records of light are to be found a complete history of Earth and of every entity which has incarnated upon it. Many of the sources, of highly attenuated densities of matter, were invisible to earthly eyes and could only be detected by radar. Also, any of the sources could be rendered invisible at any time, or could be disintegrated by either explosion or implosion. Thus Earthlings had seen some apparently burst in a blue or white flash while others seemed simply to vanish in the air. I remember wondering about Captain Mantle and several others who believed they had contacted the sources. In reply to my thought I heard these words, Captain Mantle was not pursuing the planet Venus. He was endeavoring to overtake and capture one of the remotely controlled disks. His death was absolutely unavoidable. We wish to tell Earth's people that visitors from other planets occasionally visit Earth's dense, heavy, gaseous atmosphere. All are of kindly intent and none will harm man. All intelligences capable of space travel can read thoughts and see emotions. Man believes himself civilized, but often his thoughts are barbaric and his emotions lethal. We do not say this as criticism, but state it only as fact. Thus it is best to approach all planetary visitors with friendly, welcoming thoughts. As I listened to his words, I wondered why these incredible beings hadn't landed several spaceships at one of our large airports and thus convinced the world simply and quickly of their reality. In answer, I heard these words: "That would be the way of the entities of your Earth, Orpheo, but it is not our way. Primarily because we function in dimensions unknown to man and hence interpret all things differently. Also, because there are planetary and cosmic laws as implacable as the natural laws of Earth. Cosmic law actively prevents one planet from interfering with the evolution of any other planet. In other words, Orpheo, Earth must work out its own destiny. We will do everything in our power to aid the people of Earth, but we are definitely and greatly limited by cosmic law. It is because the life evolution in its present stage of material advancement upon Earth is endangered that we have made our reappearance in the atmosphere of your planet. The danger is far greater than Earth's people realize. The enemy prepares in vast numbers and in secret." For a moment the voice was still and then it said gently, "Among the countless other worlds in the cosmos, Orpheo, the children of Earth are as babes, ultimate of knowledge. Among the worlds of the universe are many types of spiritual and physical evolutions. Each form of intelligent life adapts itself to the physical conditions prevalent upon its home planet. Most of these evolutions exist in more highly attenuated forms of matter than upon Earth. But the majority are rather similar to man in appearance. There is a definite reason for this being so. In reality, we are Earth's older brothers and thus we will aid Earth's people insofar as they, through free will permit us to do so." As I listened to that kind, gentle voice, I began to feel a warm, glowing wave of love enfold me, so powerful that it seemed as a tangible soft, golden light. For a wonderful moment I felt infinitely greater, finer and stronger than I knew myself to be. It was as though momentarily I had transcended mortality and was somehow related to these superior beings. "We'll contact you again, Orpheo," the voice said. "But for now, friend, it is good night." The two shimmering green discs faded almost out, then I heard a low hum as they flamed brilliantly into glowing green fire and shot up into the sky in the direction taken earlier by the larger red disc. In an incredibly short time they too had vanished, leaving me standing alone by my car. Bewilderment, incredulity, shock and stark fear flooded over me, sudden conviction that I had lost my mind and gone raving mad. What I had witnessed, I felt, just couldn't have happened. I raised my numbed hand and it was trembling violently. I saw by my watch that it was almost 2 o'clock in the morning. I climbed shakily into my car and kicked the starter. Panic was mounting in me. I twisted the steering wheel, gunned the engine and made a sharp, fast U-turn to get back onto the road. The tires screamed and the car lurched. I wanted to get home quickly. I wanted to get back to the world of sane reality. I wanted someone to assure me I wasn't going mad. I drove with only a single objective in my mind: to get home. When finally I made the turn onto Glendale Boulevard, picture, and saw the lights of my apartment, I breathed a heavy sigh of relief. No place had ever looked so good to me. I left the car in the driveway and ran into the house. My wife was waiting up, worried and anxious because I was so late. "Orpheo, what's the matter? What's wrong? You're white as a sheet." I stood staring at her, unable to speak. She came to me and grasped my hand. "Orpheo, you're sick. I'm going to call a doctor." I put my arms around her. I wanted only to feel her close to me and for the moment to try not to think of what I had been through. She pleaded with me to tell her what had happened. "Tomorrow, maybe tomorrow, May, I can tell you." Finally we got to bed, but it was almost dawn before I drifted into a troubled half-sleep. Chapter 2: I travel in a flying saucer. I spent nearly all day Saturday in bed. The shock of my fantastic experience was so great that I found it difficult to get back to actualities. I kept having the feeling that the world I knew was a phantom world inhabited only by shadows. It was not until Sunday that I could bring myself to tell my wife what had happened to me. I was afraid she would think I had lost my mind. Thus it was with relief I heard her say, "If you say it happened like that, Orfeo, I believe you. You've always told me the truth. But this thing is so strange and frightening, and you looked so deathly white when you came in." I could only put my arms around her as I replied, "It scares me too, Mabel. I don't know what to think." Sunday afternoon I took my 12-year-old son Richard and drove back to the spot on Forest Lawn Drive where I had seen the discs. There in the loose dirt I found the deep skid marks the tires of my car had made Friday night. Richard looked at me curiously and asked what I was looking for. I pointed to the skid marks and told him that was the spot where I had seen what could only have been a flying saucer. Richard stared incredulously. "But Dad, I thought you always laughed at people who believed in those things." "You're right, son," I replied. "But that was only because I didn't know any better. Friday night I saw three of the saucers from this very spot." Richard's eyes widened with interest. Then he began shooting questions at me so fast that I had to ask him to slow down. But I was glad he did not doubt my word. Seeing those skid marks where I had gunned my car in panic to get away from the eerie spot assured me of the reality of my experience. I was convinced that I had been in contact with beings from another world. Monday night I went back to my swing shift job at Lockheed. It felt good to be back at work again. The friendly banter, laughter and jokes of my co-workers were just what I needed. Beyond my family I told no one of that first experience, as I knew I would be ridiculed. In fact, even at home very little was said about the saucers or my experience, for the subject invariably upset my wife and filled her with such apprehension that even the boys refrained from talking much about it. But when I was alone I thought long and often about those incredible beings from that other world. The voice had promised, "We'll contact you again, Orfeo." I wondered when they would get in touch with me again and how. Had they meant soon, or would it be months or even years? These and hundreds of similar questions clamored in my mind. I wondered if I was under constant observation by them. If so, I thought that through telepathy I could signal them to return. Night I went back to that lonely spot on Forest Lawn Drive and tried to establish telepathic communication. But it was useless. No glowing red disc appeared, only the night and the empty skies that gave back no answer. Weeks passed and still no further sign from them. Doubts began to trouble me. Time dulled the memory of that night and I began to wonder if my experience had actually been real after all. Then early in July there began a fresh flood of well-authenticated sightings of saucers in the skies over Southern California. Local newspapers carried banner headlines announcing flying saucers over Los Angeles. Some people were convinced we had interplanetary visitors and looked for mass landings at any moment. Later in the month, additional sensational sightings were reported from many other states. It seemed the skies were filled with the baffling mystery objects that defied all natural laws and behaved more like phantoms than material realities. As I avidly read each new account, I became convinced anew that I knew the secret of the flying saucers. But I longed for more knowledge. I hoped and prayed for another contact with those incredible beings I had seen so briefly that Friday night. July 23, 1952, I didn't go to work. I wasn't feeling well and believed I was coming down with the flu. I was in bed all day, but in the evening I felt a little better and thought to walk in the fresh air would be good for me. I walked down to the snack bar at the Los Feliz Drive-In Theater, several blocks from the 11-unit apartment court where we live. The small cafe has a warm, friendly atmosphere and it gave my spirits a big lift to listen to the small talk and friendly ribbing. Because of the many recent newspaper reports, the talk turned to flying saucers. Anne, One of the waitresses laughingly remarked that she couldn't get enough sleep as her husband insisted upon staying up most of the night watching the sky with binoculars trying to get a glimpse of a saucer. This brought on a round of flying saucer jokes and everyone was laughing, including myself. The fact that I could laugh indicates that I had pretty well gotten over the shock of my experience. When I'd finished my coffee, I left the snack bar and started home. It was a little after 10 o'clock. Beyond the theater is a lonely stretch of vacant lots. The place is eerie and forbidding at night, for huge concrete buttresses rise from it supporting the Hyperion Avenue freeway bridge several hundred feet overhead. The bridge cast dense, oblique shadows down below, making it a shadowed no man's land. When searched net for Hyperion Avenue freeway bridge, I got this one but not sure it is right. Row, as I crossed the vacant lots in the deep shadows of the bridge, a peculiar feeling came over me. Instantly I remembered that sensation, the tingling in my arms and legs. I looked nervously overhead but saw nothing. The feeling became more intense and with it came the dulling of consciousness I had noted on that other occasion. Between me and the bridge I noticed a misty obstruction. I couldn't make out what it was. It looked like an Eskimo igloo, or the phantom of an igloo. It seemed like a luminous shadow without substance. I stared hard at the object. It was absolutely incredible, like a huge, misty soap bubble squatting on the ground, emitting a fuzzy, pale glow. Pic.Rune made, the object appeared to be about 30 feet high and about equally wide at the base, so it wasn't a sphere. As I watched, it seemed to gain substance and to darken perceptibly on the outside. Then I noticed it had an aperture, or entrance like the door to an igloo, and the inside was brilliantly lighted. I walked toward the thing. I had absolutely no sense of fear, rather a pleasant feeling of well-being. At the entrance I could see a large circular room inside. Hesitating only an instant, I stepped into the object. I found myself in a circular, domed room about 18 feet in diameter. The interior was made of an ethereal mother-of-pearl stuff, iridescent with exquisite colors that gave off light. There was a reclining chair directly across from the entrance. It was made of that same translucent, shimmering substance, a stuff so evanescent that it didn't appear to be material reality as we know it. No voice spoke, but I received the strong impression that I was to sit in the chair. In fact, a force seemed to be impelling me directly toward it. As I sat down, I marveled at the texture of the material. Seated therein, I felt suspended in air, for the substance of that chair molded itself to fit every surface or movement of my body. As I leaned back and relaxed, that feeling of peace and well-being intensified. Then a movement drew my attention toward the entrance. I saw the walls appeared to be noiselessly moving to close the aperture to the outside. In a few seconds the door had vanished, with no indication that there had ever been an entrance. The closing of that door cut me off entirely from the outside world. For an uncomfortable moment I felt utterly alone, lost to my family and friends. But almost immediately a pleasant warmth passed over me, giving me once more that feeling of peace and security. I breathed deeply and found the air cool and fresh. Vaguely I wondered what was going to happen next. Then I thought I heard a humming sound. At first it was almost inaudible, but it grew to a steady, low-pitched rhythm that was more like a vibration than a hum. Next I was aware that my body seemed to be sinking more deeply into the soft substance of the chair. I felt as though a gentle force was pushing perkalialy, pleasant sensation that put me into a kind of semi-dream state. While the humming sound increased, I noticed that the room was darkening as though a heavy shadow was engulfing the room in twilight. As the light dimmed, I began to grow apprehensive. I had the realization of how alone and helpless I actually was. For a bad moment I was on the edge of panic in the tightly sealed, darkening room. Then, I heard music. It seemed to be coming from the walls. I couldn't believe my ears when I recognized the melody as my favorite song, "Fools Rush In." The panic within me subsided, for I realized how safe I was with them, they who knew my every thought, dream and cherished hope. Reassured, I settled back to enjoy the music. In a few seconds, the interior of the room began to grow light again. Soon it was more brilliantly lighted than ever. It was at that moment that I noticed a glittering piece of metal on the floor of the craft. It was the shape and about the size of a quarter. I reached down and picked it up. It was different from any kind of metal I had ever seen, for it seemed almost to be alive in my hand. It quivered and began to glow almost like a live coal, yet it remained at the same temperature as my body. Now I noticed that the piece of metal was diminishing in size. It was as though some mysterious kind of sublimation or degeneration was taking place before my eyes. Could it be that contact with my hand was causing the substance to dissipate in the air? I placed it back upon the floor of the craft. There it ceased to quiver and the odd glow was no longer apparent. I leaned back in the chair and noticed my soiled, faded work clothes which I had worn when I went to the snack bar. The coarse fabric appeared crude and glaringly out of place in the exquisite, shimmering mother-of-pearl room. Where are they taking me? I wondered, as I half listened to the music. For I was certain that the craft I was in must be moving. Were they taking me to their world, or was I going to spend eternity lost in space in that pearly igloo? While I was still pondering these questions, I felt the push against the surface of my body lessen, then cease altogether. The music stopped playing and humming vibration in the floor died away too. I was certain that whatever type of motive power was used was housed somewhere below the floor as the faint vibratory hum definitely came from there. Then smoothly and noiselessly the chair made a quarter turn toward the wall. Even as much as I trusted my unseen friends, I was a little frightened at this. Tensely I waited, gripping the arms of the chair. Directly in front of me a circular opening appeared in the wall about 6 feet in diameter, but everything appeared hazy through it. As I stared, the lights inside darkened. Then either the entire craft or the seat turned slightly more to the left and the strange window widened about 3 more feet. I saw a huge globe surrounded with a shimmering rainbow. I trembled as I realized I was actually looking upon a planet from somewhere out in space. The planet itself was of a deep, twilight blue intensity and the iridescent rainbow surrounding it made it appear like a dream vision. I couldn't see at all, for a portion at the bottom of the sphere was cut off by the floor line. Now I heard that voice I remembered so well. Orfeo, you are looking upon Earth, your home. From here, over 1,000 miles away in space, it appears as the most beautiful planet in the heavens and a haven of peace and tranquility. But you and your earthly brothers know the true conditions there. As I listened to the tender, gentle intonations of that wonderful voice, an overwhelming sense of sadness came over me. I felt tears in my eyes, I who had not known the relief of tears since I was a small boy. My heart was so full of emotion that tears were the only possible expression. They flowed unheeded down my cheeks. I was not ashamed, for the tears seemed somehow to cleanse and purify me and to break down the hard, unfeeling, crystallized shell of the reasoner that I had come to pride myself upon being. The voice said softly, "Weep, Orfeo. Let tears unblind your eyes. For at this moment we weep with you for Earth and her children. For all of its apparent beauty, Earth is a purgatorial world among the plants evolving intelligent life. Hate, selfishness and cruelty rise from many parts of it like a dark mist." The words brought fresh tears to my eyes as I thought of conditions on Earth and how they must appear to these perfected, compassionate beings who had extra-dimensional sight. There was silence for a moment. Then I noticed that the room was apparently revolving away from Earth. Gradually the heavens came into view, an awesome, breathtaking sight from that tiny craft. All space appeared intensely black and the stars incredibly brilliant, set like jewels against black velvet, large, small, single and clustered. I felt lost in a strangely beautiful, ethereal world of celestial wonder. All was brooding silence, order and indescribable beauty. A deep feeling of reverence possessed me. I had never been an actively religious man, but in that moment I knew God as a tangible, immutable force that reached to the furthest depths of time and eternity. And I felt assurance that the beings in whose care I was at that moment were close to the infinite power. For a moment there was deep silence. Then as I wiped away the tears I saw a fantastic object coming slowly into view through the window. It resembled a dirigible except that it was definitely flattened at the bottom. It emerged gradually into view from the right. I studied it closely, wondering at its composition. It did not appear to be metallic like an airplane, but was definitely crystalline and give it illusion of transparency. Its light properties definitely suggested perfect crystal alloyed throughout. I surmised it might be some sort of crystal metal plastic combination. When the entire ship was in view, it appeared to be at least 1,000 feet long and about 90 feet thick, but it could have been a great deal larger, for there was no way to judge how close I was to it. I stared fascinated at the half-ethereal ship, scarcely conscious that I was again hearing music. But as my ears caught a startling, unfamiliar strain, I listened intently to music such as I had never heard or could imagine. It is beyond description, for it was not music as we know it, nor was it played to a musical scale. It was strange, haunting drifts of melody that brought visions of star galaxies and planets spinning in notes of perfect harmony. The voice spoke again, "Brother of Earth, each entity of your planet is divinely created and immortal. Upon your world the mortal shadows of those entities are working out their salvation from the plane of darkness. Every person upon Earth and its adjoining planes of manifestation are definitely arrayed upon either the positive side of progression toward good, or on the negative side of regression toward greater evil. We know where you stand, Ufio. But are you going to be content to drift as you have been?" "No dot 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 oh, no," I replied impulsively. "I want to work constructively. Only grant me strong physical health and there isn't anything I shan't be able to accomplish," the voice replied gently. "That wish we cannot grant you, Orfeo, as much as we might like to. It is only because your physical body is weakened and your spiritual perceptions thereby keener that we have been able to contact you. Had you been physically in robust health with your mortal body and mind perfectly attuned to the sluggish lowered vibrations of Earth, we could not have manifested to you. Sickness, ill health and all mortal afflictions are transient and unreal. They, along with pain, sorrow, suffering and conflict, make up mankind's lessons in the school of the world where wisdom and spiritual evolution are gained primarily through suffering. An explanation of this terrible enigma will be given to you later. But tonight we tell you that you can rise above the inadequacies of your physical body, Orfeo, as may all other Earthlings. Remember always that we love you and your brothers of Earth. We will do everything within our power for the children of Earth that they will permit us to do, through free will." With these words, the huge ship I was observing began moving upward and toward the left. One large portal after another opened in rapid succession as the ship ascended until what appeared to be three decks were visible and I could catch fleeting glimpses of the interior of the gigantic skyship. The inside appeared to be of the same luminous mother-of-pearl substance as the interior of the craft I was in. But I saw nothing more, no sign of life, no furnishings or equipment such as we on Earth know. As I watched the ship, I realized that the voice as well as the ethereal music had actually originated in the great sky ship. It came to me then that this must be a mother ship and that beings in it had remote control over the movements of the saucers that skimmed and skipped through our atmosphere. It awed me to realize what a high degree of intelligence and what expert hands were behind the saucer phenomena. I felt ashamed of having pleaded for a healthy body, who had already been granted so much. As the craft moved further out into space, I noticed what appeared to be a rotor at each end of the ship. I say rotor, but actually the things appeared to be vortices of flame. With my limited knowledge, I judged these incredible disks of fire to be tremendously powerful power plants whose terrific energy could be diverted to almost any purpose. The disks I had first seen were used as radio transmitters and receivers, then as a huge three-dimensional television screen on which, through some method of telepathic contact, it was possible both to see and to hear. Now I saw those same disks apparently propelling the vast skyship. It was my guess that just such a power plant had shot the very craft I was in 1,000 miles out into space in a mere matter of minutes and without any discomfort to me. It was clearly evident that all of the bewildering and insurmountable problems of space travel that baffled our engineers and scientists had been overcome by these people to such an extent that the entire trip into outer space was as simple as a ride in an elevator. I wondered if they had discovered the secret of resisting gravity with its counterforce. If not, then by what other means had they conquered or neutralized gravity? I remembered that Earth's scientists believed that a man in a spaceship would be absolutely weightless and apart to float about. I lifted my hand and let it drop to the arm of the chair. It behaved precisely as it would have on Earth. There must be an artificial gravity induced in the floor of the craft. I wondered too how they had overcome the menace of lethal cosmic rays, meteors, sky debris, etc. Surely my ship carried no tons of lead shielding scientists declared necessary for adequate protection from cosmic rays. Also, I wondered in what way they had mastered the terrific pressure and temperature changes so that I was never conscious at any time of variations in either. And their motive power, what was the fantastic secret of those green fireballs? Possibly they were vortices of magnetic power which operated almost silently and with astounding efficiency. What a wonder world their planet must be, I thought, as I gazed in awe at the crystalline dream ship passing from my line of vision. Slowly then the room turned back toward the left and the Earth appeared once more with its shimmering rainbow halo. Dimly I could make out the faint outlines of the Western Hemisphere and varying shades of misty blue. Also I could see faint puffs of light scattered here and there which I judged to be the larger cities of the North American continent. Two flying saucers darted into view and sped downward toward Earth. Just as abruptly they decelerated and hung suspended in space as pinpoints of light. As I was wondering about them I heard the voice say that one was over Washington, D.C. and the other over Los Angeles. Los Angeles. The word echoed in my consciousness as I gazed at the faint brush of light that was a great sprawling city. I tried to remember that Los Angeles was my home, but it seemed only vaguely familiar, a place remembered somewhere in time. Tonight, Orfeo, the voice continued, you have explored a minute distance into the limitless highways of the universe. Through your own efforts the road may later be widened for you. Tonight you, an entity of Earth, have come close to the infinite entities. For the present you are our emissary, Orfeo, and you must act. Even though people of Earth laugh derisively and mock you as a lunatic, tell them about us. I will I will. I whispered haltingly knowing that everything I said was heard by them even as all my thoughts were known to them. We know you will, Orfeo, the voice replied. Thus tonight a special privilege has been yours. We love the children of Earth and it is our desire to help them as the hour of crisis approaches. But only through such harmless ones as you can we work. The aggressive men of Earth want our scientific advancements. For these they would shoot our crafts from the skies, if they could.